I was started to be introduced as my husband's wife, and that really started to grate on me.
Erica Doyle, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You mentioned that you stopped drinking in 2005.
For me, it was for family planning reasons. My husband and I, we were trying to start a family for a good few years, and it just wasn't happening. We went to see our local GP. When he said, do you drink, do you smoke? I said, well, no more than normal people. And he just said, try giving that up for 3 months, 6 months, and see where you are. I then did get pregnant, and then I started drink dry.
You've never had a drop since 2015?
No, I haven't.
What was the motivation?
Having my own business was never something I intentionally wanted to do. Everybody had this misconception that the demand wasn't there. I was my own frustrated consumer. I've just had enough of being a stay-at-home mom. It's almost like I started losing my own identity in the business circles, and that didn't sit well with me.
Guys, Matt Haycox here. And welcome to another episode of the Matt Haycox Show, where today I have a guest who is a pioneer of the zero alcohol movement here in the UAE. She's a founder of Drink Dry, which is the GCC's premier non-alcoholic drinks marketplace. She's also won Entrepreneur Woman SME Leader Award. Have I said that right?
Yeah. There's a few awards in there, so I'm just trying to see which one you're talking about.
And the Arabian Business's 50 Most Inspirational Woman list. You're on the women list. Anyway, Erica Doyle, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It all sounds very exciting. I've never had anyone on the show to talk anything to do with non-alcohol, whether that's, you know, not drinking alcohol or drinks. So I'm looking forward to covering all things.
How much time you've got?
Well, I've got my water, my non-alcoholic water. So I can sit here and listen to stories all day. But I mean, look, just before we started recording, you mentioned that you stopped drinking in 2005.
That's
and
right.
I didn't ask you why, because I do like to be surprised in most of the questions we do. So go on. Is there a backstory to that? Why did you stop drinking?
There is, yeah, and I think everybody who comes to reevaluate their relationship with drinking or alcohol has their own backstory. For me, it was for family planning reasons. I don't think I was ever a huge drinker anyway. And my husband and I, we got married and we were trying to start a family for a good few years. And it just wasn't happening. And we went through kind of the early stages of fertility treatments and everything else. And then we went to see our local GP when we lived in the UK. This, I don't know, he must be 75 or older than that. You know, and we were having a chat with him and he said to me, darling, you know, what's your lifestyle like? He said, do you exercise? How much do you sleep? What food do you eat? Do you drink? Do you smoke? And when he said, do you drink, do you smoke? I said, well, no more than normal people. And he just said, you know, try giving that up for 3 months, 6 months and see where you are. And that's exactly what we did. We had this bigger goal, this bigger picture of this, thing that we wanted. We wanted a family. So both my husband and I have decided to change our lifestyle, and it just one thing led to another. So I think initially it was giving up that Friday night drink and Saturday night drink and giving up that odd cigarette that you have when you're out with friends, into not drinking at all. And then you find yourself that you're sleeping much better and the choices in your diet you're making are much more sensible and much more reasonable. And you find yourself having a lot more energy. And then you're going to the gym. And then it turns into 5 times a week in the gym. And 6 months down the line, you are the fittest you've ever been. So this was kind of like my journey.
And have you've never had a drop since 2015?
No, I haven't. And it's not my intention. You know, I never say never, but I then did get pregnant and I'm now a mother of 3 beautiful little girls. So I had them very close one after another. They're 6, 5, and 3. So I think as part of the whole journey, I discovered these amazing non-alcoholic drink options in the UK that just acted like such a great substitute for dinner parties that we were hosting. And if I didn't want to justify to anyone why I'm not drinking, whether I'm breastfeeding or I'm pregnant or whatever is the reason, that I always had a drink that looked like an adult drink and nobody was asking me why I was not drinking. And then I started drink dry. And then it just feels, I genuinely don't miss it. It's not a thing that I feel I'm missing or lacking in my life. I never say never. Look, if somebody opened a really phenomenal bottle of wine that I've not tried or I've always wanted to try, I might. I say that, but I'm not even sure that's true, actually.
Because I could tempt you with that. I've got some good bottles in the fridge.
Well, yeah, maybe. Maybe that would work. You know, 2 years ago, I went to a dinner party and to a friend's house, and it got to about 10 o'clock in the evening. We've had dinner, and they whipped open some exceptional wines out of their wine cupboard. And I think they had one or two bottles before that, so it was very easy for them to open. And under any other circumstances, I would have said, yeah, I'll have a glass. But I had a meeting the next morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I just thought, somebody who hasn't had alcohol for 7 years, to have a glass already late into the evening when I've got to be on my top form the next day. And I said, no, thank you. And that for me was also another turning point where I thought, maybe this is it. Maybe this is, you know, I just won't go back to it.
I mean, I've got quite a few friends at the minute who've given up for a while. I wouldn't say anyone's
dry
given
January?
Up for good. No, like for periods of time, like, you know, like a full year. I mean, a very good mate of mine, he did 12 months, which finished 7th or 8th of January. So, you know, we then went out to celebrate his year off the booze. And he managed to get himself, you know, so obliterated during the kind of 24 hours that he'd gone out for, that he woke up the next day and thought, that is why I don't drink. And it's,
exactly, it's
very easy to stay off it. But I guess, everyone's got their own relationships with alcohol, haven't they? I mean, you know, people who are quitting always say to me, oh, why don't you try quitting as well? I said, well, for me, I don't need to quit because I don't have a problem with it anyway. You know, I can take it or leave it. As I was saying to you before we started this, I only really drink good red wine. I've never touched beer in my life. I don't really have an interest in the spirits because I don't want to feel shit the next day, you know, and I kind of appreciate that the older I get, the more difficult it is to get up in the morning, that, you know, even when I'm drinking the wine that I like, you know, a couple of glasses, three glasses, I'm feeling groggy the next day, I'm feeling lethargic the next day. Now, if I decide that I don't mind that feeling because it's going to be a byproduct of drinking some great red, then that's one thing. But to drink a vodka Coke, for example, well, what's the point? I mean, you can't even taste the vodka in the Coke. You know, I might as well just have the Coke on its own and not have it with it. So I find it very easy to take it or leave it. So I've got no interest in stopping because I don't want to put that, you know, that kind of, whether it's a label or whether it's just makes it so formal and terminal at that point, then you almost feel pressure then, don't you? But I mean, I can go weeks or months if I want to without having a drink.
A lot of our consumers and a lot of our customers are moderators. There's so many different terms that the industry has now come up with to try and segregate and to put them in different kind of categories of what are the reasons the consumer's choosing not to consume alcohol. And when I first launched Drink Dry, we made one critical mistake in terms of our initial kind of market assessment. We segmented our consumers based on who they are, religion, ethnicity, age, gender, to try and understand how we market to them. Well, that completely didn't work for us. And until we did the exercise and then segmented our consumers based on their why would Bob, John, Karen, Muhammad chooses to have non-alcoholic drink over alcohol or over a super sugary mocktail, that's when we hit the jackpot, because we were able to speak to them in the language that they knew was aimed at them. So if you take, for example, you know, we've got five different kind of very broad segment, consumer segments that we, in our head, it's our Bible. This is who our consumers are. And of course, there's always cross between the segment groups, and there's always new ones that we're not too familiar. But the five ones that we normally work with are young parents, obvious one for what reasons, pregnant ladies, our kind of, you know, our gym goers, so people who are hugely into their physical exercise. It matters, the calorie intake matters to them. The way they look matters to them. These are the people that go to the gym and put their physical looks and well-being above all else. And this is where the non-alc drinks come in handy, based on calorie per drink. You know, we're probably about a fifth in calories when it comes to alcohol versus non-alcohol. Then we have the consumer group, which are more wellness focused. So their kind of like motto is think globally, act locally. These are the people who do look at the back of the label, but not for the calories. They're looking for, Are there any preservatives? Are there any E's in it? Is this product genuinely good for me? Is that something that is good for my body? And then you have people who we consider as our kind of business audience. So these are the people who are high achievers, people who, you know, these are the people that everybody says they have more hours than anybody else in the day. This is how they have it, because they up at five, they go to the gym. So that's a real cross-category consumer for us, cross-segment consumer for us. They go to the gym, they are really busy at work, they have big careers, they go out, they socialize, yet there is no room for alcohol because they simply cannot afford that lethargic feeling the next day because they have to be back on their top performance the next day. I think that would probably resonate with you. So this is where we put another kind of consumer segment in there. And whenever we're doing any activities or any activations or marketing, we always think of which consumer group are we speaking to here? The most obvious one, that probably the sixth one in this region, would be people who don't drink for religious reasons. And with Ramadan fast approaching, it's something we did last year, but we did it very culturally sensitively. So instead of trying to say, hey, look, these are non-alc drinks and you need them during Ramadan, we didn't feel that was the right message. So instead, we looked at people's behaviors and patterns and traditions, how they observe Ramadan and what is part of their iftars, what is part of their Ramadan month of celebration. And we simply introduced our products where we saw it fit. So as you know, Vimto is a huge drink here during Ramadan. Whether we like it, whether we don't, whatever we perceive it to be, Vimto is a huge part of the hosting celebration of iftars. So we introduced really nice mocktails with our sparkling wines and Vimto. So it's halal drink, but it just elevates the experience rather than having Vimto and water. We introduced Martini Vimto Fizz, and it's just a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more celebratory, and gives it a nicer, sophisticated vibe. But the religious kind of segment, we've always treaded very lightly and really carefully, because the last thing we want to do is offend people who don't want to do anything to do with alcohol.
Tell me, I know this might sound almost like a stupid question, but I mean, I've never really drunk many non-alcoholic drinks. I guess because, I mean, I've just been looking at your range, you know, online now, and you've got obviously got lots and lots of stuff. But really, when you think back to England, the only real non-alcoholic drinks, it's just non-alcoholic beer, really, isn't it? And as a non-beer drinker, I've got no interest in drinking non-alcoholic beer. But what's the difference between taking one of your non-alcoholic products, you know, whatever, like a non-alcoholic martini you just mentioned, or just having a Diet Coke? You know, I mean, ultimately, isn't a non-alcoholic drink just another kind of flavoured soda?
No, I think, you know, no, like full on no. And I'll give you a couple of reasons. If you look at the whole non-alc category, these are relatively new brands. These are the brands that maybe emerged, say, max 5-7 years ago. So the manufacturers and the producers of these liquids, of these new brands, are so in tune with what the consumer is looking for. The consumer isn't looking for 16 spoonfuls of sugar in a glass of Coke. The consumer isn't looking for sugar-led. So if I'm answering your question in terms of like a soft drink, why choose non-alc over soft drink? The consumer is looking for a sophisticated, flavor-forward, tasty drink opposed to just a very simple soft drink led by sugar. Because if you look at any soft drinks, whether by juices or sodas, sugar is the lead flavor in it. If you remove sugar, you have very little left in it, whether it's Coke, Pepsi, Fanta, anything along those lines. You remove sugar and you have very little left in it. So
what they're putting in a diet drink, then, like, I mean, I'd be drinking
sweetener. Okay. So it would be like a sweetener, anything that is kind of a sugar replacement, right? The manufacturers and the producers of non-alcoholic drinks, they're so in tune with what the new age consumer is looking for that they're creating genuinely very tasty drinks that it's aimed at adults. So it's not a category that it's aimed at children. The children can stick to the soft drinks and the milkshakes and everything else. It's a category that is aimed at adults who are looking to... They don't want to drink alcohol, but they equally, on a night out or at dinner, don't want to drink a glass of Coke or orange juice. They want to have something that feels celebratory, that feels sophisticated, that feels it's good for them, so they're not consuming masses of sugar. And it just complements the meal as well. And I think the biggest crime committed particularly in the Middle East when it comes to F&B, you have some incredible F&B outlets here, genuinely incredible. Food is phenomenal. The chefs are amazing. The ambience, the atmosphere, the location. But the actual drinks offering has always been so incredibly lazy. If you look at non-licensed, particularly where they can't have alcohol, the drinks selection has always been very limited and very lazy. So as a well-to-do adult who's going out on a Friday night or Thursday night in Dubai and you want to treat yourself, have a really nice meal, you've got the spending power, you've got the money to spend, but there's nothing for you to buy that's more than 12 or 15 dirhams in the drink section. And that's where Drink Dry comes in with a new age drink proposition for the consumer. And then there's a whole new commercial aspect that we can talk about when it comes for the operators as well.
Okay. And you keep mentioning sugar. Are the non-alcoholic drinks, do they tend to be low calorie as well?
Yeah.
Like, or all of them are?
Hugely,
or
that's... hugely. So if you look at, for example, if you look at a bottle of Corona, so Corona Zero, the non-alc version of the Corona beer, is only 56 calories. That's a quarter of the calories that a Corona Extra has. If you look at our premium sparkling wines, French Bloom, it's only 14 to 19 calories, depending on which variant you go for.
A glass.
A Prosecco or champagne has 90 to 100. The same with non-alc spirits. Most of non-alc spirits genuinely don't have any calories because it's just flavor in it, like flavorings inside of it. Because sugar, because what is alcohol? Alcohol is sugar that is fermented in any way. So you take wine. How is wine produced? They pick the grapes, they make grape juice, they put a load of sugar and a load of yeast, that ferments and that becomes wine, that turns into wine. If you then remove alcohol and you remove the sugar in the product, you're left with very little calories inside, which is much, much healthier and much better for you.
Well, let's go back to the start of the business and talk about the business a bit. So you stopped drinking in 2015, but when did you actually form the business?
So we lived in the UK at that time, and my husband has had a business out here since 2008.
So you were coming backwards and forwards.
So Dubai was familiar. We had friends. We, you know, I knew my local supermarket. It was a familiar place to be and come, and I think we'd always spend about 3 months a year in Dubai. And then we started having our family and became increasingly more difficult to travel with the more kids we were having. And in 2019, we made the decision to permanently move to Dubai and base ourselves here. And that's where the kind of, I think, the frustration as a consumer for me started, that I was genuinely very frustrated consumer in this market. And using exactly that example, I remember in 2019 when we moved, going to Prime 68 in JW Marriott, which was one of my favorite restaurants to go to. Fantastic food, great service, great atmosphere, great views. And the one thing I'd always feel when we'd leave really annoyed is that I didn't have anything good to drink. We'd always drink water because I don't like sodas. I'm not going to have orange juice with a really great steak. I'm not going to ruin it. And there's nothing else for me to drink. I don't want to have a mojito with a load of sugar. So we'd always drink water. And I'd always say to my husband, isn't it a shame that as two working adults with good spending power, we're going out to a really nice restaurant and we can't spend the money. There's nothing for us to buy. And the same story would go when you'd go to supermarkets. You know, you think, well, as a non-drinker or somebody who's moderating their drinking, what do I drink on a Friday night at barbecue? What do I bring with me? Or what do I have as a host for people who maybe are driving? And there was just nothing available in supermarkets. And even looking online to drop ship or ship and whatever is, you know, shop and ship, you couldn't do that because it's a food item. So even buying something in UK or America, you couldn't even ship it into the country. It's not like a pair of trainers that it's much easier for you to import, right? Because these products look, feel, taste like alcohol. So it's not easy to import that. And that's where, so I think the first 12 months of us living here in Dubai was the kind of the roots were seeded. You know, I was incredibly frustrated as a consumer. And I remember thinking, there has got to be more people like me who are either non-drinkers or moderators, or pregnant, or, you know, whatever is the reason they're choosing not to drink, there is nothing out here in the market for them to drink. And then I think after the initial 12 months, that's when Drink Dry was born.
And what were you doing for work before this?
So, oh my gosh, my personal background, there are two things I never thought I'll do genuinely is have my own business. Never had the ambition. I know some people are born with kind of the feeling of I could never work for somebody else and I only want to have my own thing. That was completely the opposite of what I kind of set out to do. I studied history and politics at University in Nottingham, and I worked as a parliamentary researcher in London. Then I worked at the Lithuanian Embassy in London in the political section, super happy with the kind of work I was doing. And then I became a mum. So I took 4 years out and then we moved to Dubai. So I went from almost like a civil servant career to stay-at-home mum. And that for me came to an end. Somebody who had a lot of ambitions throughout their life to find myself four years with, you know, leggings and dirty t-shirts and a mum bun, that came to an end for me. So having my own business was never something I intentionally wanted to do.
So when you did start it, what was the motivation? Was it just simply a byproduct of the fact that you couldn't find the drinks you wanted and you thought you'd go and solve your own problem, or was there a more grander business plan there?
I would say not in the first 12 months, truly. In the first 6 to 12 months, no. I think there were two. One is a personal reason where I've just had enough of being a stay-at-home mum. And particularly because we moved to Dubai, you know, something started to happen which really annoyed me every time we were going out. I was started to be introduced as my husband's wife, and that really started to grate on me. That anywhere we went, I would always be introduced as, this is so-and-so's wife. Hi, meet so-and-so, and this is his wife. Hi. It's almost like I started losing my own identity in the business circles that, you know, I was so used to being part in the UK. And that didn't sit well with me. I was a mom of two girls, a third one on the way. From the feminist perspective, that's the last thing I wanted to do, is to have my young daughters see me as my husband's wife, you know. And my husband is very successful in his own right. He's well known in his industry. He's an industry leader. He's a philanthropist. He's older than me. So he's done his part. He's achieved his kind of business goals. And the last thing I wanted is my children to see me as a younger trophy wife who was daddy's wife, who was Patrick's wife. And that didn't sit well with me at all. So I think that was from the personal reason. And I think back then I didn't realize how powerful that was, because when things got hard in the 2-3 years when I started Drink Dry, I'd always find myself coming back to that why. So I think that was a lot more powerful than I initially gave it credit. And secondly, I was my own frustrated consumer, and I genuinely believe that the reason the supply demand wasn't, nobody was talking about it, no distributor was looking into non-alc, because nobody was able to understand the real demand in the market, but because there was zero supply of the products that I wanted to bring into the market. I'm not talking about really rubbishy malt beverages that were selling for 5 dirhams a bottle. I'm not talking about grape juices in a champagne-style bottle. I'm talking about really great, sophisticated non-alc alternatives for adults. And nobody was looking into it. Therefore, everybody had this misconception that the demand wasn't there. And when we launched our website, so I started the company in February 2020. It took us probably 6 to 9 months to get our things in gear, get the products.
And you say us, was it just you? Did you have any partners, investors?
Yeah, I made a really smart choice. And I found a co-founder from day one. She is, I talk about her very rarely because she's our silent assassin. She's the brain behind the business in terms of the e-commerce. She's ex-Deloitte. She was one of the leading teams on Deloitte who took Selfridge's John Lewis online in the UK. So I went to an industry pro and I said, look, I have this idea. The business was meant to be just e-commerce at that moment in time. And I said, come on board. We can do this really well together.
Was it a conscious effort? So was it a conscious decision that she was a female as well?
Probably not, but I think at that moment in time, again, I was a mum with two really small kids, and I felt that, and she was the same. Our kids are very similar age, and I think I genuinely felt that going into business at that vulnerable stage in my life, when you have two kids and you have to drop anything at a minute's notice because you have two small kids, right? I think going into a business with somebody who could relate so well to that and really have your back and understand and appreciate either way was really comforting. And it was it meant a lot. So I think it probably wasn't a super conscious decision, but again, a subconscious one that I didn't give enough credit at that moment in time. So I offered her to kind of, you know, let's go into this and do this together. And I made a list of all the things that I think I'm good at and all the things I'm not good at that I think this business needed. And I think she ticked 10 out of 10. And so it was a no-brainer. And as I was ticking, I was like, so when I did my list, okay, these are my strengths and this is what I can bring to the business. And this is, I had no idea what e-commerce is. I had no idea what paid media is. I had no idea what marketing is or even what platform to use for an e-commerce. I just knew that this is roughly what we need to do. And this is going to be our business plan. And this is how the business is going to evolve. And when I looked at the list of things I needed from my co-founder, it just screamed her name. Like, it was so obvious, you know, and I thought, I can't believe I'm so fortunate that I know a person who fits that criteria almost perfectly. So I made a really, I think, smart decision in terms of having a co-founder. And I talk about this a lot when it comes to the co-founder dynamic. For me, it was really a blessing because from day one, we found our strengths and our weaknesses and we both accepted it. And she's a co-founder that I trust immensely, immensely. And I will go to her with any dilemma I might have and openly and vulnerably say, I'm lost. I just don't know what to do. What do you think? And she would come into the same conversation vulnerably saying, this is my opinion and this is what I think we should do. But whatever you decide, we'll do it. So there's a really clear understanding on who makes the decisions within the business. And we are both very comfortable with that dynamic. None of us have a big ego. None of us have anything to prove. And it just really works between the two of us. So for me, that dynamic of having a co-founder and almost like a sounding board, you know, it's talking, it's when your mouth is talking, your own ears are listening. So sometimes all I need is half an hour of her time, me talking, and I hear the answers myself while I'm talking. So yeah,
what are your strengths?
People is my strength. I am very good with people, and I think this is something I've learned from day one. Not just
what, relationship building, sales,
all of it, I think. And you know, to start a business from zero, and I now have a team of 15 people, and when I look at them, and we have a team meeting every Monday, it makes me emotional. It genuinely, I sit there and I think, how on earth did I manage to convince every single one of you to join the team? Some of them 3 years ago, and I poached them from good jobs that they had, good career progressions that they had. We've never been able to pay above the market price. So we always pay normal market price, right? But I think as a small business, we do offer flexibility, working from home. You know, we're a young business. I think I'm 35 and I'm one of the eldest in the team. So we're very young, dynamic, pragmatic business, and we offer other things that maybe more old school, traditional businesses would be too scared to offer people working from their home country for X weeks, a year, and so on and so on. But attracting talent and attracting people and getting them to buy into the vision that I had for the business. I don't think at points I even was clear what that vision is, but I managed to bring them on board and their skills and get them to fully commit to what I wanted them to do.
And how do you think you did bring them in? I mean, did you have a written plan? Did you have something to give them and show them? Or do you think they just listened to your passion, even though you didn't 100% know what your own direction was?
I think it's a mix of both. We were always very well funded as a business. I think from employees' perspective, that's always post-COVID, remember, as well. So a lot of people have lost their jobs, might have been financially challenged in 2021, you know. I think we had an angel investor from day one before I started the business who funded us up to about 2.5 million dirhams.
Is that someone you knew already?
Yeah, somebody from the drinks industry. So we had funding in place and we were fully backed because they believed as much as I did in the boom of non-alc that was going to happen. So when you asked me, did you have a business plan and why did you start Drink Dry? initially it was for personal reasons, plus that I wanted these products in the market. But very quickly, within the first 6 or 12 months, you could feel it. It was almost like lightning somewhere in the market. You could feel that non-alc globally, and you know, my husband is in drinks industry as well. So I was part of the bigger conversations amongst the alcohol distributors, amongst the alcohol manufacturers at different events, dinners, meeting people. And you could just feel that the whole non-alc was, something was big was going to happen. And I think, so we had a backer who was backing us to the hills until we brought in our next round of kind of investment. And then just getting people excited about what we were going to do and how we were going to disrupt the category, having Lena, my co-founder, on board, and that we were going to do something really phenomenal when it comes to the e-commerce space. And only 3 years in, we go and win the Arabian Business E-commerce Company of the Year, beating Deliveroo in the final. I mean, that's in 3 years, that's a really exciting achievement, you know, and that's all down to the people who came in and believed in the vision and said, okay, let's roll our sleeves up and I'm going to give it everything I've got to make it happen.
What about some problems in the early stages?
Which ones?
Well, you tell me. And I mean, obviously, it's all, you know, I can see your passion. I can see the excitement of something that's, as I guess, has had a very clear audience and, you know, and found its feet from day one. But there must have been, you know, plenty of road bumps along the way.
I think the biggest one for us is we are still too small on our own to educate the consumer. And all the questions that you are kind of asking me before we started recording, it's every question our consumer has in their head, right? What's the difference between an alcoholic and non-alcoholic drink in taste, calories, this, that, the other? People still lack a lot of education and awareness around the category, and it needs a lot of big global names and brands, and it needs a lot of money to educate the consumer. What we've always done from day one is we were good at being creative, and kind of like with the bootstrap budget that we had, the content we were putting out, you know, we were trying to be creative and educating it. But the biggest challenge we had, and we still do, is educating the consumers and spreading it wider and catching the wider audience, you know?
Is it your job to educate, or should the big brands be doing it for you?
I would say it's a mix of both now. Drink dry in the UAE, amongst the kind of the drinks industry and the consumers, we are now the go-to. And a lot of people have heard about drink dry. They don't know what we do. They know it's something to do with non-alc. And this is my favorite thing when somebody says, you're the lady from drink dry. You do something to do with non-alc. I'm like, that's it? That's great. That's enough. On the budget that we've had and the space of time that we had, 3 years, that's enough for you to know drink dry. And that there's something we're doing non-alc. You don't need to know that I'm a distributor in HoReCa. You don't need to know that I'm the distributor behind the non-alc brands in supermarkets. You know, you just need to know that I do something in non-alc. That's good enough. But I think now is the time where we would like to see, and we are seeing, big brands, the likes of Diageo, the Pernod Ricard, the Asahis, the AB InBev, the Heineken Brewery, all the big players coming in and saying, you know what? Heineken Zero and Corona Zero is a priority now in our portfolio. So we're going to go above and beyond invest, you know, and it needs that kind of support for wider awareness. So I think that's always been our biggest challenge in wanting to be that category leader from the education perspective, but not having enough funds to do that.
Is there a bit of I was going to say a catch 22, but that's probably the wrong expression. But let's say a bit of a conflict with the big brands that, look, you know, they've got, for example, a non-alcoholic Corona because they know they need to have one. But they also realise that for all the pushing they do on the non-alcoholic Corona, it's ultimately going to take market share.
Absolutely not.
Right.
Absolutely. Could not be further away from the truth. So if you look at which is widely available, if you look at the ABIs, for example, who are the brand owners of Corona and Stella and Leffe and a lot of global beer brands, if you look at their own strategy at their release, probably 2022, their goal and their aim is to have over 30% of their total sales in non-alc by 2030. But, and it's led by the fact that They're not stealing market share from the alcohol equivalents of the brands they have. Alcohol sales, particularly alcoholic beer sales, are in decline. So you have two options. As somebody who owns Corona as a brand, you have two options. You either let the brand go in decline and you lose that new generation, Generation Z, coming in who aren't choosing Corona as a brand. They're choosing anything else that's non-alc, or you release a really excellent liquid with a Corona Zero branding on top of it and you still keep that consumer within your sales. So you don't lose that consumer to another product or another category. You keep them within your pool. And the biggest misconception is that the non-alc sales are cannibalizing on alcohol sales. This could not be further away from truth. Somebody who's going out on a Friday night and says, I'm going out and I'm having a really great time and I'm going to drink, that's what they're going to do. They're going to go out and they are going to drink. Somebody who's going out on the same Friday night and says, I'm not going to drink tonight because X, Y, Z, what they're going to do is drink Coke, Pepsi, water, orange juice. Or if you have Corona Zero in your bar, restaurant, at a barbecue entertaining, they will drink Corona Zero. So more than anything, you are probably taking away the sales from the soft drinks category than you are from alcohol.
Has beer had its day? I mean, is it on a decline that's always going to be a decline, do you think? Or do you think that'll plateau? Or do you think it'll ever rise again?
I think it'll plateau. I think alcohol will always be popular. And there's always room and time and place and celebration for alcoholic beer, champagne, anything, right? So I don't think it'll ever go into a massive decline. But I do know for a fact that then the generation, the millennials are changing. Our biggest, if I look at our consumer data, there's no Nielsen data for drinks available here in the region. So we always use Drink Dry Store as our kind of holy Bible for any data because we're the only ones doing it. We've got 3.5 years worth of data and we use that as a, that's what the market is, right? So if I look at my consumer base, I have a really beautifully split 50-50 audience between male and female. So I know that I'm speaking as much to females as I'm speaking to men on our e-commerce. And the biggest age group that is currently shopping on Drink Dry Store is the millennials, 35 to 45. So they're the people who are drinkers and non-drinkers, and they are also moderators. But you've got the Generation Z who are coming through who aren't hugely into drinking, and they have no affiliation to alcohol brands and they want to drink differently. That's the biggest kind of, that's the slogan. They want to drink differently. So they're turning into non-alc. So if you don't do anything as a producer, as a manufacturer of alcoholic drinks, you're simply going to lose the next couple of generations. And, you know, that's going to affect your business hugely.
Are you planning to go more global with this ultimately, or are you going to be concentrating on the areas where you are?
I think in two minds in terms of, you know, the short-term to medium future, I think we definitely, there's a lot we still have to do in the Middle East. It's a huge market. Saudi is our second market in terms of size and revenue, what we do to date. But we haven't even scratched the tiniest little surface of it. We only went into Saudi last year. So there's a lot to do there. I think we know our territory. We know what we're doing here. I think a lot of messaging around non-alc in the West, particularly if you look westwards, whether that's UK, Europe or US, it's around non-alc being a replacement for alcohol. And that's where it fits in and that's where it lives. We have found a sweet spot where non-alc drinks, yes, they are a great replacement and alternative to alcoholic drinks, but also they are a great replacement for sugary mocktails that are so dominant here that we are able to come in. So moving away from the beer kind of conversation, that we are able to come in and redevelop really sugary-led mocktail menus of big F&B operators here, replace the sugar syrups that they're currently using that are zero taste, just sugar, with our exciting non-alcoholic spirits by reducing calorie intake, by making it more commercial viable for the operators, by introducing better flavor for the consumers. So there's a lot that we can do in the Middle East that we probably couldn't do in the West. So for that reason, we're quite comfortable with the Middle East. I think going far east, you know, the likes of Malaysia, there's a reason people don't drink there. And I think the whole religious aspect there is a bit more dominant than it is here. So we have a lot more learning to do here, how to gradually and softly introduce our products to those people who don't drink alcohol without offending them. So I think we have a lot more to do here before we go east with that concept.
And as someone who's, well, I guess you're truly international, Lithuanian born to UK living to now doing business in the UAE. Tell me about some business cultural differences.
In Dubai?
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I mean, yeah, there are cultural differences, and we have probably, we're a team of 15 and we have 7 different nationalities in the team. So of course you see different cultural differences in terms of, the time people like to start their day. Some cultures, some nationalities are early risers. They like to be in the office at crack of dawn. And some people like to start their day later, but work later, right? As a business owner in 2024, I couldn't care less what time people get into work and what time they leave. All I care is about the result they're doing. So despite the cultural challenges that we have here in Dubai, I think there's a common business language that comes from good leadership that manages to unite them all. So I don't think it's in any way a problem or a challenge, any cultural differences here, as long as you manage to unite people for the same goal and purpose. And I'm not a micromanager. It's not something I wanted to do. And I've always hired people who are a million times better than I would be at that job. So when you are a founder and you start something, you have to be a jack of all trades, and you have to do a bit of marketing, a bit of commercial, a bit of order processing. You know, you've got to do a bit of everything. But there comes a point where you are starting to recruit people for those specific areas, and they have to be a million times better than you. And if I'm hiring these people and paying them good salaries, I don't want to micromanage them. I just want to make sure I unite them, that they all work in sync, that they're all driving for the same goal, for the same vision. And to me, it really doesn't matter what kind of cultural differences come into that or what the preferences are for people.
Where have you learned all this? I mean, obviously, as someone who never saw yourself working in business, and you talk about a lot of very good, very true, very progressive business, business theories, leadership theories, and stuff. I mean, have you tried to educate yourself? Has it been accidental? Do you still learn now?
I like to read, and I've always liked to learn from other people's mistakes. I think that's. Podcasts, I live and swear and die by them. You know, I never have to listen through it all. But if somebody says to me, oh, have you recently listened to XYZ on XYZ? I just need to hear 10 minutes of it for that one nugget, for that one clip. You know, I'm currently reading the Super Founders book about the founder dynamics, because I was always so intrigued. Why me and my co-founder, we're just the perfect match. We are so different as characters. If you meet me and her, you'd think, how on earth are you even friends, let alone, business partners? We are so different in every single aspect, yet we make a perfect match. So I will find a book that will kind of go through the what makes perfect founders. I'm like, this is why, I listen to podcasts about leadership, management, people management.
Tell me a couple of your favorite podcasters. Other than me, of course.
Other than you, of course. I like to listen to not so much people who have podcasts, but I like to listen to the guests that they have.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
Always the guests that I follow, I think I tend to gravitate to females in business. So Karen Brady, her episode on Diary of the CEO, it's just next level.
I'll have to make a note to remind myself to listen to that later.
It's amazing. And she talks about, you hear these things and it just hits home to a point where you can't unhear them, where she talks about the difference between leadership and management. And it's 30 seconds and you hear that and you think, yeah, that is absolutely true. So I will step back from the management part of the business because I have 5 people doing that. Thank you very much. And let me go and do what I'm good at. And then it kind of frees you as well from feeling I need to have my fingers in all the pies within the business. No, I don't. I absolutely don't. So I do like to learn from other people's mistakes. And I'm genuinely always very intrigued to speak to people who started businesses, failed, rebuilt again, or sold or exited or whatever they've done, I think there's a lot of power in that.
You say that you kind of gravitate towards female podcasts. I mean, do you think there are some material differences between men and women, as business owners, business operators?
From the business space, no. But I think if I take a bit more holistic view of that, and I'll give you some personal examples of mine. As I said to you, my husband is very successful in his own rights, what he's done. He's built a fantastic company. He's got 120 people working, 4 different cities globally, super successful. When we got married in 2014, he was on the cusp of really going up. And we had a deal. I said to him, look, I'm going to now leave my job and my career in London, and I'm going to dedicate myself to making your life easier. So take away any domestic, humanly responsibility from you. The guy no longer knows what bank we're with. He doesn't know.
Sounds dangerous for him.
Also true. But I took away, he had a 10-year-old son who lived with us. I took away every single responsibility from him, from running a household, from childcare, to looking after his elderly mother, to house project that we were doing, absolutely everything. And he just 100% applied himself to his business. And he achieved enormous success in probably less than 5 years. Then I start my business, and from being somebody who is stay-at-home mom, who's managing our property portfolio, has 3 kids, is responsible of sending gifts to my siblings, his 5 siblings, he's Irish. He never had any of these responsibilities. So when I tried to step away from my personal life and my children and everything else, the mental load that comes from running a family as a business and running a life of a family unit, it took me 4 people to replace that. I had to replace myself as a stay-at-home mum with 4 people. 2 nannies, a driver, and a personal family assistant. And I'm not ashamed of that, because it took me 4 people to replace that. I'm in a fortunate position that I can financially afford to do that. But if you can't do that, then you've got a man who's running his business, and on the whole, and I'm exaggerating to make my point here, on the whole, doesn't have a care in the world about a broken sink in the house, about a school book day that the kids need costume for on a Tuesday, or anything else. And then you have a woman who's an equal partner in that family, who's running her business and also is responsible for a million other things that come as part of the mental load. So I think for that reason, for me, as somebody who went into business having had all of that in the background, I naturally tend to gravitate with people who I know understand me as a person, me as a mom, me as a business owner, me as a wife, me as a house manager, a little bit more and a little bit better. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think my husband to this day, he lives in this beautiful world of his own where he never has to know about any plumbing issues we have in any of the houses or anything. He's just happy, jolly go lucky.
Do you ever go to him for advice for your business, or do you like to keep things separate?
Always, always. I think you have to. I think I carried a lot of the natural kind of knowledge into the business by having years of conversations with him. Somebody who comes home to you every evening and is telling you about their day, about their challenges, about somebody they're having to let go and how that's going to look like, or an issue they're having with a supplier or distributor or warehouse or insurance or anything else it might be from running a distribution business effectively, which is similar to what I do, you learn, you listen and learn. And when you're faced with a situation 18 months down the line, you think, I remember, and you might refer to that in your head as a potential problem solving. So I think I've, particularly in the early days when I was setting up the business, and I think he's too far removed from the nitty-gritty details of my business. But in the early days, for sure, when I was setting up the business and making sure that I got the fundamentals right of just setting up a really good business, he was always on my back in the nicest possible way. have you got your accounts in place? Have you got your cash flow in place? Have you got your forecasting in place? Like, the, and he always used to say to me, you can't know where you're going if you don't know where you are today with your business. And he used to say that to me day in, day out, day in, day out. And as a young business, we are, from that kind of foundation, we are really well run, because I've had somebody always like a little angel or devil, which way you look at it, sitting on my shoulder, saying to me every single day, have you done that yet? Have you done that yet? Do you know that? Do you know that? Are you able to give me your margins? Can you tell me what your cash flow looks like? Do you know where the break-even point is? Always asking all those right questions that, as a founder of a small business that's growing fast, you always find an excuse. I don't have time for it. I'm so busy. I don't have time for it. So I think he's been really critical and fundamental in helping me put those foundations in place, particularly in the early ages.
Talk to me about fundraising, because I always say that, you know, raising funds is probably the most difficult thing that any small business will ever do. I mean, it sounds like you've done it at least twice with your angel investor and get just the two times.
Two, yeah.
Talk to me about that. I guess preparing for it. You know, going out to find the investors. You know, the process and negotiation.
I think my story is probably somewhat a bit unusual. So when I came up with the idea of Drink Dry and what it would look like in the short term, medium term, long term, it would be e-commerce, then going into hotels and restaurants, and then retail, and that we would then kind of, I always say, we sit at the top of the food chain, right? If there's a brand who's looking to enter this market, we are the people they speak to, and then we will take on the brand, we will do the importation, distribution, and then we might decide and choose to work with other big, much bigger players than we are in the market, and we will sub-distribute to them for a particular channel, for a particular brand, and we've managed to achieve that. So my story in terms of fundraising was always a bit, I think it's been a bit unusual, and I attribute that to the fact that the whole non-alc category, for people who knew it and the people who were interested in it, it was such a fascinating category that I didn't have to do much selling into the business itself. So our initial angel investor came on board through my connections in the drinks industry. It was somebody who was very well aware of this coming boom of the non-alc. So I didn't have to convince them much. And I think the investment that we eventually kind of like took from them in the region of 2.5 million dirhams wasn't much for them. So they were financially very strong partner for us for an angel. So we could have probably gone a bit further with them than we did. So that wasn't really a big challenge, because they were almost looking for somebody to do what I was about to do. So when we met and we started having conversations, it was a really quick decision from their side that we're absolutely backing you. This is what we want you to do. And, you know, they never, ever once interfered in any decision making. It was just the money behind it. They'd look at our accounts, look what we're doing, and they were super happy with that. And then in July 2022, I sold minority shareholding to a private family office here based in Dubai, who have strategic interests in hospitality. So they have a hospitality group here, food tech, automotives, you know, last mile delivery companies, cloud kitchens, you name it. They've either invested or I invest in a lot of different things anyway. So there was a lot of strategic interest, and it was actually them who approached me.
Okay.
So I think it was the summer of 2021, so a good 12 months before we actually signed on the dotted line, they approached me with a proposition to come in and invest. And you know, we danced around a bit. We did the usual kind of like dating game, yes, no, but not yet. And then eventually we kind of found the sweet spot of the valuation of the business that satisfied me, because it was really difficult to value a company that only been trading for a year. How do you do that? You know, what metrics do you use for that? So when we eventually found the number that satisfied them, that it was still a really good value for money from the investment perspective, and it satisfied me as somebody who knew where the category is going to go and where the business is going to go, I sold minority shareholding to them in 2022, and they've been backing us ever since.
Did you take much external advice during that time, or was it back to the books and the podcasts? I did.
I think I've always been fortunate in terms of having very smart friends around me. So, you know, the person who kind of sat on my right-hand side throughout all the negotiations was, he's a CFO in a different company. His kind of USP is he prepares gas and oil companies to be listed. So really, really strong commercial background, financial background. And he talked me through. And these are the people, I think, once you approach people that you know closely, you're not afraid to say to them, look, I know that you are pro in this field, but please leave your work jargon behind the closed door and speak to me like I'm a dummy. So dumb it down. Make it super simple for me so I understand, because this is the first time for me I'm doing it. So I have to understand everything at its core for me to then level up. So when I'm going into negotiation with my now chairman, I'm able to understand the valuation at its core before I'm able to negotiate with him. And I was really fortunate that I had those people with me throughout the process.
Did you have mentors in your earlier life, or is it just something, I guess, something you've understood the concept more of now you've moved?
I did. I was actually, one of the best things I did, I think it was back in 2021, the Dubai Chamber of Commerce, who I've worked with a couple of times since then, they launched a mentorship program. I think they initially did it in COVID as a bit of a, let's do something, you know, small businesses are dying here. Let's do something quick to connect small businesses with bigger businesses, whether it was for funding, cash, advice, business opportunities. And they saw a lot more success in 2020 with the program that they kind of half put together, launched really quickly. And they saw success with that. So when it came to beginning of 2021, they launched a full-on mentoring program where they were connecting industry leaders with small kind of founders, startups that had a lot of sort of same synergies. And I was really lucky to be connected with a guy who was then the CEO of Alibar Enterprises. So Imar, all the hospitality kind of sits under that. And I worked with him for 18 months. And I think we were in that year, we were kind of like the star mentor mentee. We did a whole kind of speech at the end of the awards at the end of 2021. So I've always taken help. I'm never shy to ask for help. And when the Dubai Chambers approached me and said, would you be interested in this program? I said, absolutely. You know, but this is the criteria I want from my mentor as well. So I think I've had a lot of kind of probably shorter stints of periods where I've been close to people in different industries, whether it's finance or business or legal, as and when I needed them. I don't know if we've gone into, if you would class that as a formal mentorship, but I've always kind of had these little small stints of people I meet and I think, I really like you. Like, just as a person, like, I really like you. And I think it's amazing what you're doing. You're an industry leader in the legal world. Can I buy your lunch? You know, and then 2 months later, can I buy your coffee? Can I invite you to dinner? And just always kind of picking people's brains on the questions I might have on a particular topic.
Well, it's been a whirlwind 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously so much happened in such a short space of time. And like you said, particularly during COVID as well. Where's the future going? What do you think the next 3 or 4 years are going to hold? And is there a planned exit?
I think that's always a plan for somebody who started their first business at 35. I think it'd be mad if I said to you, yeah, I want to run this distribution company for the next 26 years. It's definitely not the goal and the plan. I think exit is definitely part of the plan. When it will happen, it's a bit more fluid. I think we have a bit more work to do with Drink Dry before we can kind of entertain that. We went through a really big round of hiring last year. So we went from a team of 7 to 15. And boy, did I underestimate how difficult it is to hire good people and how difficult it is to give them proper induction and how much time it takes to onboard them and to really give them all the tools and the resources so they can.
Did you pick all of those roles, all of the growth, or all people that you've put personally into?
Joint effort with my commercial director, who has been employee number 2. And I would say he's probably almost like a third co-founder in that dynamic. He's kind of stepping in more and more into the role of running the business. So it was a joint effort. You know, we used a recruitment agency a couple of times. But I think the hiring process, it's easier than the actual induction process and onboarding people in the right way to give them the right tools and the skill set to then, okay, off you go. Like, you're on your own now and you need to go, because we are a small team and you've got to do your part to contribute. You know, nobody's going to hold your hand in 2 months' time. I think I underestimated the onboarding process a lot more. So that took a lot of time and a lot of effort. I would say 95% of the people we hired are still with us, and we had one who didn't stay with the team.
You wanted to get rid of them?
Yeah. And it wasn't so much get rid of. I think it just wasn't a natural fit. They were with us with it probably 3 months, and it was a very mutual decision for us and them, initiated by us to say, look, I don't think it's the right fit. And they were like, I agree, I don't think it's the right fit. So it was pretty easy.
How soon after the hiring did, you know, obviously you've been getting rid of them in 3 months, it's still a relatively short space of time, but, you know, I mean, I always find that I really know within a couple of days. And now, whether or not I'm making an excuse to drag it on for a month or two or three, I don't know. But if I really truly look back, you know, as soon as that person started, I know they've not been the right fit, and I've made some cock up on the hiring process. I mean, could you tell much earlier on?
Correct. I think there are two things that I try not to mix up when I get that feeling of I know or I don't know. As long as the person is the right fit culturally, work ethic, and attitude-wise, I'm very patient. I'm probably more patient than I should be, or other people who can't afford to be, like in a small business, I can't afford people to take too long to onboard and get going, but I am. If I see that they're culturally the right fit for the business, that they get on with everybody, that work ethic is absolutely there, and the attitude, the can-do attitude is there, if they're lacking in skills or if they're lacking in know-how or something isn't quite clicking for them work-wise, I'm patient. And I think, again, that's been one of the things that when we were building our team, we've always been very patient. And we bring somebody on board, and I always ask the whole team, it's almost like a support network, you know? We've got to stay with that person for a good 2 to 3 months and make sure that we do everything we can from the business perspective to help them do their job. If it hasn't worked in 3 months' time, and once we let them go, they can't run on their own, then it's the wrong decision. Then they simply don't have the skills to do that. But I think I know what you mean about the feeling you get if they're the right fit or not. I think with the person we let go, I knew instantly it wasn't the right fit, but we hired them in August. So we were going into our busiest period of 4 months, and I genuinely need them. I needed them for the business. It was better to have them than not to have anybody, and I've made that conscious decision. And they were good to work with. It was a good person. Like, we enjoyed having them on the team, but I think it was their skill set and the attitude that just never got up to the level it needed to be. But on the whole, I think you get a feeling and a vibe for the person pretty soon after.
Well, listen, Erica, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here. I'm looking forward to trying some drink dry products soon. It's a shame you didn't bring it for me to sip my way through during this podcast. But I'm sure we'll do a round tour. We'll have to meet up outside of this sometime anyway. Just I know we talked about drinkdrymarketplace.com.
Yeah, drinkdrystore.com.
Store, yes. Yeah. So just give yourself a shout out so people know where to go and find.
So drinkdrystore is the leading marketplace for all the non-alcoholic drinks. We have all of the products that are exclusively represented by us as a company, but also other brands that we find in the market that we deem fantastic and we think they're good enough to be listed on drinkdrystore. So from the consumer's perspective, they can confidently go to drinkdrystore.com and search the brands, the categories, the products, compare the pricing to find what they're looking for. And we do same-day delivery in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. So if you order before 11 o'clock in the morning, we deliver to you the same day, 7 days a week.
Right. Well, I will definitely be putting an order in before the weekend.
Erica, thank you, Matt.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.